Accession number 28416, Real 6.
Bill, you were saying that Dick Howe, who was a tank driver, was your escape officer, the British escape officer.
Yes, that is right. He was one of the 51st Highland Division who were all taken after Dunkirk had closed down. And he'd escaped from somewhere in order to have been sent to Colditz, but I don't know where. And he was jolly good. He had a friend with him, Lawton, Lulu Lawton. Was a North Country lad, and he and Dick Howe, you needed to have somebody to talk with and work things out with, and they made a jolly good pair. What was the first British thing that followed on all this? I can't think of another one. Oh, well, Aerie Neave, he'd gone before this. No, he hadn't. No, he hadn't. No, there indeed. Oh, golly.
Let's just stop for a moment then. Aaron Eve was
one of the very successful escapers because he got right the way home. And,
I mentioned Aaron Eve because I know nothing at all about his escape at all except that it was a British success. Which were pretty few and far between compared to the number of attempts. But I'd like to describe, because the park is in our mind at the moment, because of the Dutch folk, and this is where I first saw happen what I mentioned, I hope, in our Greek walk to the Salonika about how a chap escaped, the instant escape into the culvert. Well, this was very similar. When we used to go up, this was later on, of course, when we were building our glider, actually, or we were building something. Yeah. No, we were making a wheel, actually, to turn a dynamo to run the radio set. And on upstairs, in the, away from everybody, was this chap who would be up there always when we got up there, and he got an enormous great bed. A blanket, actually, not a blanket, a rug, no. What do you call a large thing you have in the car to keep yourself warm? You don't call them blankets, do you?
A car rug, really.
A rug. Yes. Had a great rug, which he was, he'd be standing beside the wall, and he'd have this rug in his hand. It looked perfectly normal, warm rug. And suddenly he'd make a dive for the deck and swish this rug over himself. And the reason why became clear when I saw him do the escape. On the walk down to the... mustn't touch the table. On the walk down to the park, there are some buildings on the way, open doors, shut doors, little alcoves, places to put things out. And there's a heap of swept-up rubbish. Quite a big one. And Beaumont, he had spotted this, and spoke to Dick Howe about, look, I'm going to be that bit of rubbish down there. Do you think that's all right? And Dick was all for it. Because although everybody was walking down like a march past, you might say, with the Germans on each side, making sure you didn't do anything odd, he had to be sure he could just nip to one side and swing his rug, which is covered with bottles, tins, mud, anything that he could find to make it look like that rubbish heap. And he practiced at it day after day after day. And he did it. He must have also told friends behind to do some diversion. He got to do it, not when that chap was ready, but when he was ready to go there. And they would easily have laid on a diversion, dropped something in front of the German with his rifle, so he's got to stop while you pick it up, for instance, and he looked down at you, and he's in. And he got out of the camp, dear old Beaumont, but it was so sad. He walked about a couple of miles, I suppose,
And when he met some German guards coming back from the town, and they recognised him for what he was. He wasn't a local. And that was awfully sad, I thought, because if he'd got on a train, he'd probably made it, because he's a very inoffensive person. In fact, he turned out to become a priest in the end in England. I mean, I think he still is, actually. Beaumont.
Is he still alive?
I'm sure he's still alive, yes. Yeah. Because I met him, I went to Dick Lorraine's funeral, and Beaumont came to that and spoke up from the pulpit, actually, about Dick. Now, more escapes. When did we find one for ourselves? Well, before that happened, Jack Best and Mike Sinclair got sent off towards the Dutch border. They had a wonderful idea that at dawn, the Germans changed the war after the lights came on. What way around it was. I think they changed the guard after the lights had come on. So the old guard are sitting there and it's getting a little bit dark. And they, from looking out of our windows, you could see where the guards walked up and down the hard balcony outside. It was more or less a balcony where they were. And there was a little boundary wall, and then you went down another layer to the garden below, and you went across to the wire. And if they could get out of that window, down, across, and up, they were out. And so more windows were, bars were taken off, and Jack and Mike were given wire cutters and a plan to get a railway line and go to Holland. And it was a tricky moment, of course. They were all set up, they put a table against the window so that he could be slid out. I think one of the chaps there was a naval coxswain. He's 95 now, he's still around. And he had made the ropes from bedsheet, long ropes, very good at making rope. And I think he'd seen chaps who'd been killed on board, like your machine there sat parked there. Imagine a body on it, and that's the end of the wall, or in a ship, it's the side of the ship, where you lift up this end and send the coffin, I don't suppose they call it a coffin even, out with the chap in it, down. And that's what was done with Jack. So there he is. I was in the room with him then, that happened. I can see him lying on his table now. Mike's gone, successfully down, rope pulled up again, and Jack on it, out through the window, and the German still in his goon box, just there, and the one hasn't come out from the guard room here. And Jack gets out and hangs on to his... No, Mike had the wire cutters, hangs on to himself, gets down all right, and then across to the balcony, over that wall, and down the rope again. And at that moment, a guard came out of the guard room just there, walking towards the guard in his... What's it called?
Post. Sentry box.
Sentry box. Walking to his sentry box, driven to shout up at him, what's happening? What had happened is the only way to describe the thing, that he'd come out and he looked up and down, couldn't see anybody. And I suppose he said, okay, and he walked back in again. And Jack went across, joined up with Mike, and Mike was pinging away at the wires, and they did half make a ping, and they got through and down. I must just say at that point why it happened that he didn't get picked up. As Jack went across that boundary wall, that little barricade, there was a bell to press there if the goon on duty walking up and down there wanted to call the guard room. He would press the bell and out would come the corporal. And Jack had pressed the bell. Out came the corporal, but he wasn't old and he couldn't see very well, and it was nearly time for the lights to be on, and they weren't on. And he walked back again. Now, if that isn't a bit of luck, heaven send. However, they scrambled down the wire, which is all barbed wire on the ground outside the camp, I think, and there was a lady hanging some washing, or taking washing off her line at the bottom. She looked at them, watching her line, didn't say anything to anybody, thank goodness. I don't know where, what they did exactly after that, but I don't know whether they got a train that night or not. But the fact is, they did get to Reine, which is about 20 miles from the Dutch border. R-E-I-N-E, I think it is Reine, Reine, perhaps. And that's where their train stopped them. And they had to get out to get on the next little bit. And unfortunately, they were daylight now. They were, I think they were stationary in the town, looking in a window perhaps at something they'd seen, when a policeman comes along, and he doesn't take long to realise who what they are, and they take them in the station. It's what I said earlier about the Germans had more policemen than they did individuals, I think. Anybody who wasn't doing exactly what they should have been doing.
But National Socialist Germany was a police state.
It was a police state, exactly. It was so sad they'd got that far to Reine, and they would have had a Dutch house to go to.
Yes, of course.
I'm sure. I don't know which one. I don't, because all those Dutch folks would have been. And so Jack was brought back, and Mike. Mm. At that point, we already had the Colditz glider underway.
So tell me about that from the beginning, can you?
Right.
Because this is the most, in one sense, although it never happened, and therefore never worked, this is the most audacious attempt to get out of Colditz by any nationality, isn't it, or not?
Not really. I did mention it that when we were at Beaverark, we had the idea of a kite, Colonel Cody's kite, which takes you back to 1910 or 9, lift up, off we go. So we've never given up on aviation as a possibility. And we did remark to each other that, look, we're 300 feet up in the air here. Like your thing there can go off that. And the thing that had the result was when Tony Rolt was brought into it by Dick Howe, as knowledgeable that he's a good sporty person. He was army, Tony Rolt. The tricky bit was we went through a stage before Tony as the general manager, you might say. Director, because he had a good organising capability with the remaining members of the camp. They'd been there longer too.
Can I just ask, whose idea was it in the beginning to try and fly a glider out of Colditz?
Well, I don't know, I can't answer anybody else, you see. Jack and I certainly had the idea. There was one friend, a Canadian airman, who was there, who went there, not from Sargon, but from Spangenberg, that their window was at a slightly different shape to others, and we knew it had a very shallow slope roof. Sort of roof, tiles might be that, but this would be about that. And
so a very
because of
slope.
The fact it was a window in a roof, you might say.
Yes.
Although the ordinary tiles had been stopped and the special roof put in. And that struck me that it had a lovely slope which you could slide off or run off. And I could picture a single-seater whereby you ran. Now, they do this every year at some south coast port where they try and reach a little boy out from the pier. And they never got to the pier yet, I don't think. But they do a sort of fly out and down. And you can get out.
They run off the end of the pier.
They run off the pier sideways.
Yes.
Now, this was a thought that we had. We can. And
I think we had heard, but this might be a later knowledge, that on one of the aircraft carriers, they'd tried this with a glider already, to see if you can launch a glider off a carrier. And in fact, up in the lakes at the lakes up the top there, where the Campbell on his speedboat failed it.
Coniston Water, that sort of place?
Yes. They did, in fact, build a float bottom on a flying boat and try it out up there on a cable. And it's in a museum up there now, actually. However, could I just stop a moment?
I think you just said that you certainly had the idea of doing it. You don't claim to be the first, because there may have been several people with the idea, but certainly you were one of those with the idea of flying a glider off the roof.
Yes. And we were lucky in that Dick was such a good organizer that he would have made the most of it, you might say, which to him meant preferably getting more than one person out. Tony Rolt may have mentioned to his friend David Walker at the time, who'd got out of Eichstätt, I think, and got sent to Colitz together, that this height we're at is an invitation to get off the roof with the glider. So I remember our first talk with Tony Rolt, with myself and him. Just Jack was still absent with his 14 days in jail. And walking around saying, well, look, the difficulty is we've got to have hundreds of bits, small bits, little bits of wood, and stick them all together somehow. And it seemed a monumental task to be able to do that. But when Jack came to join us, the monumental mentality vanished altogether, because he was perfectly keen and willing to make the tools that would be required to build anything, apart from gliders as well. And Tony said he would be very happy to set up a company, Heavy Industries Limited, is what we were called, but to make anything, but preferably make the glider. And that's what was done. So we started making drawings, and inevitably the first thing you have to make for any flying machine is to make the ribs for the wings, because their shape decides how well it's going to fly, and there are more of them than anything else, and they've got the smallest little bits that you've got to join together. Well, in the camp, bits and tools really amount to the help that was obtained from Checo Chalupka. He was a Czech pilot who had got to the RAF and was taken over, and been a Hurricane pilot. And he was, of course, spoke German like that. And he was very good at persuading Germans to bring us in what we needed. I don't know of all the things he brought in, of course, because they were all for us, but what he did get in for us was the glue, vital fact number one for building something in the way of wood. And if only Jack were here, it would be lovely, but he isn't. But he would have helped us with what other things Checo got for us. But it was many, and he was doing it all the time. So there must have been some Germans who were moderately friendly, sympathetic, if you like, more than anything. They didn't make anything from it. They stood in dire trouble. But that was our way of getting what we needed. And initially, of course, these small parts could be made where we actually lived, and they were made on the kitchen table, or was it a dining table? It was really a rather lovely dining table, probably the standard thing they had in all the German army barracks, I suppose.
You know, did big, the Germans big, heavy. Not, Did the Germans not come into your mess rooms?
Oh, yes. Yes, they'd walk through almost every day at some time. But,
So you had to be quite good at disguising what you were doing?
Yes, and hiding what we were doing, but also, of course, warning that somebody's coming and likely to come in. So although the stooging, the goons set up, would have been fairly easy early on, because everybody was making something in every room, not just for us, but for themselves. I mean, what are they doing? Making the things that you need in passports, maps, clothing, hats, guns, pistols, anything's going on all the time. It's a hive of industry. I try and picture it must have been rather like Afghanistan in the old days when the streets were lined with chaps who made their rifles in the street and poured it out with I don't know what. And but they had to make all they needed. And so the kitchen, I mean, even under the kitchen table was quite a good place to put things, you see. You just put them up under there when you're not using them and put them on top when you are using them. And they were really good flat, and it was a good drawing board too, the table. We didn't have a drawing board actually, but that was it. But we had a bit of paper so we could draw things from John Wotton, who was the camp artist. Now, there were far more than one artist actually, because later on one sees all the lovely pictures that they made, but John Wotton was there all the time doing it. And well, he was in our mess, I suppose, at one stage. And he was a good cover-up, because if he's painting something, the Germans will look at it, and what we're doing is underneath what he's doing.
Yes.
You've got to have ways of hiding things. And good places to put things. Well, this is where Jack learnt all about where the wood is. It wasn't so much our quarters where we'd take the wood. It was from this wonderful building called the Saal House. I don't know how you spell Saal, but it sounds like S and a couple of A's and an L. But I think that means a theatre. And if your German isn't any better than mine, that'll have to do. The Saal House, that was quite close to this big gate that we all had to come through. Up a lot of steps. The theatre was up about two or three stories. And it was where the senior officers lived, including Wingard and Varda at the far end of it. And the stage was quite big, and where the people sat was quite big too. It was a vast floor area, so it was covered in wood, and they could really spare it, the Germans. In fact, I don't know how they covered up after we'd taken bits, but that was somebody else's worry, really. Perhaps we dug up a different bit from somewhere else and put it there instead. Like underneath the stage you could take bits, you see, and they wouldn't notice that unless they looked underneath. The stage is quite big. So all the floorboards under the stage must have come out. I'm sure they came out when Aaron Eve escaped, because that was his route out. And so it was easier than having to go buy wood after the war, when it was licensed. You've just got your wood. And all you had to do was to get it to where we were working on it. Now, of course, this is later on, after we were talking about spars to put the ribs on. So they'd be wanted quite early, but they were achieved.
How was that done?
Well, they were nonchalantly carried across the courtyard in front of the goon on guard. Probably, I can't even remember seeing it happening, because I was busy, I suppose. They were pretty long. They were 16 feet long. So that's the size of the room, I guess, 16 feet. It's not very big, really, is it? No. This room's about 16 feet, I think, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. They would have walked across with them nonchalantly. Somebody's talking to the goon on guard. I think I can remember perhaps seeing it once at a table, like an ordinary
not a big kitchen table, that would be heavy, but a table anyway, being borrowed from one side to the other, held on these two poles and carried across, probably with some rugs over it or something, or even bedding perhaps on it. Yeah, why not? They would have gone a route which is not obvious. Up the stairs would be the hard part, because it's a winding staircase. And so the timber arrived. This was in our top workshop, which we hadn't started with, of course, until the idea came. This has to be Tony and Dick together, I'm sure. The thinking up of how to make a real workshop where you can put a glider together. Because Dick would have been well known for, and the people he talked to, for going up in the upper parts of the castle, because the key maker was a key person to Dick, and he would be the only one who would get the doors open. And
so you had a man making keys, which would give you a set of pass keys, effectively, to all the doors that you wanted to get through. Was that what happened?
I think probably the key maker would have opened the doors for us. Possibly he would pass it to one of us to take up. I don't know. I can't remember. But it was vital to have keys, and it had become a pastime for some people, because the French, or was it the Belgians, Gieg, had a very good key-making knowledge, and he could see right inside these very expensive multi-lock keys, you know, which want a cross key and all sorts of things. He could measure the needed bits on the key. And he kindly showed Bush Parker how to do it. And Bush Parker took that up like a thousand a year income, as it were. He was a key maker for the British. And I think he gave Jack a good old insight into it. He probably gave the keys to Jack to open and shut it, actually. Yeah. Because I think Jack brought the keys home. However, there was a way up there where something could be built, the width of the castle, about 30 feet perhaps, don't know exactly. And the wonderful thing was that it had a floor in it. And this was above the room that normally inspected by the Germans, the long room, unused. For some reason, it was never used for ordinary people to be put in there. It could have been, there was nothing wrong with it. It had windows like these. But then the real roof started above that. Like, there's the bottom rafter, and the rafters go up from, sorry, the ceiling joists, and the rafters go up from that. And there was a patch there where a bit of plaster had come down. And at that point, it was decided to make an access. And resulting from shoving the ladder up and going through the hole and deciding, well, this is absolutely perfect, it can be blanked off by putting a frame across, the next frame along, up to the very tiles of the roof, to seal that fan piece off from the length of the room. 60-foot long room, 10 feet for us, 50 for the Germans. And that was the plan which appeared. I guess Dick and Tony were the ones who cooked that up and arranged it. So that's got us a workshop. And dear old Brigadier Anderson, that's him, yeah, he made the trapdoor. Perfect fit. It looked exactly properly wrong from below, like it always had looked. So the Germans had nothing to find fault or go and investigate further. They never seemed to remember to look down from when they went above into the level that our workshop was, when they sometimes went up there, perhaps, they never looked for that crack from above. Because, in fact, the floorboards would have stopped it anyway. Because our workshop was floorboarded for us. Otherwise, we should have been travelling about on the ceiling. Well, the ceiling. Yeah. Which were just ordinary laths.
And they had to come down.
They had to come down, yes. You had to have a floor.
Bill, I'm going to pause now. We're virtually at the end of this tape. This might be a moment to have a short pause anyway.
Yes.
We'll pause at the end of...